The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8888. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated August 8/August 15, 2022. The border, as usual, is bright red with a narrow inner border of white. Time is in large white block letters. It says, "Into the Megaverse." And there's a picture of what looks like a robot in a T-shirt with a heart on it and chopped-off blue jeans and tennis shoes with something that looks like a Muppet standing beside it and something that looks like Space World or whatever it's called, Future World, from Disney World behind it. Skyscrapers that are pointy. One has a big time sign on it. People in a garden area, not speaking except in emoji icons. There are space platforms that seem to be floating like thin pillows in the air. A spacecraft is shooting overhead. The coloration is multi. Mostly purples and blues with a shot of bright orange and bright yellow here and there, and of course the white space cloud pillows. Beginning now with For the Record, let's see, seven short items here. $79 billion is the supposed value of the Colosseum in Rome, according to a July 25 report by Deloitte. Oro la Lumina Attenborghi, the name of the oldest known animal predator, announced July 25 in order of British naturalist and broadcaster David Attenborough. So that's the first word in this two-word name is Aurora Lumina Attenborghi. All right, next. If he's not fired by noon tomorrow, then I want your resignation, said Brett Cross, uncle of fourth grader Lucia Garcia, who was killed in the Uvalde, Texas school shooting, discussing school police chief Pete Arredondo, whom some have blamed for law enforcement failures that day. At a school board meeting July 18, Arredondo remains on unpaid leave. "We put our love for Chadwick into this film," stated Ryan Coogler, director, July 23, on Black Panther star Chadwick Boseman, who died in 2020, ahead of the release of a teaser for sequel Wakanda Forever. 35 is the age of An-An, that's two words, A-N space A-N, the oldest male giant panda under human care. Upon his July 21 death at a theme park in Hong Kong, "I want it to be good, and I was not sure I could be. I did not sound too bad tonight," said Joni Mitchell, singer, to CBS on her July 24 performance at Newport Folk Festival, her first since suffering a brain aneurysm in 2015. And finally, on this page, "We know this may be very disappointing. We hope you will try our other delicious frozen treats," said Klondike, announcing July 25 it is discontinuing the Choco Taco after nearly 40 years. From the brief in headline form, Temperature Tantrum by Ciara Nugent. As the UK hit record high, some on the right urged Britons to stay cool and carry on. A photo here, nearly a full page of some sunbathers, I would say. They're not dressed in swimming attire, but two young women are lying on the deck of a pool dressed in shorts and tank tops, skimpy tank tops, with their heads in the water of the pool. In the background, there are more people sitting on other edges of the pool, and behind them, in a blurry format, some of the large old buildings of probably London or another old UK metropolitan area. This is by Ciara Nugent. Calm down, it's just a sunny day. That was the refrain from a small but powerful section of the British establishment, as temperatures in the UK, where summer highs rarely reach 30 centigrade, 86 Fahrenheit, topped 40 centigrade, 104 Fahrenheit, for the first time in recorded history in mid-July. Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab of the ruling Conservative Party told the public to relax and enjoy the sunshine. Conservative lawmaker John Hayes called people who worried about the heat cowardly. Right-wing newspaper The Daily Mail bemoaned that sunny day snowflake Britain had a meltdown. Another tabloid, the Daily Express, offered a cheery spin on the UK's famous wartime slogan, "It's not the end of the world, just stay cool and carry on." The Blitz spirit could not stop runways from melting at UK airports, though, or help London firefighters put out blazes that raged across overheated buildings, or give school kids enough energy to learn. For most people, sweltering in homes designed for a different climate, the heat was oppressive and disruptive, if not terrifying. If you're reading this in the U.S., the disconnect might sound familiar. The impacts of climate change have been politicized in American public discourse since the 1990s. Now the U.K. has imported what's an argument less about science than culture and money. Hayes receives a nearly $60,000 a year salary from an oil trading company. The Daily Mail ran an op-ed arguing against meteorologists' doom-laden heat warnings, written by an energy company consultant. And like the mainstream U.S. right, U.K. conservatives have moved beyond questioning the existence of climate change to disputing the need for action. An editorial for The Telegraph claimed the UK's heat wave is a sign that efforts to stop global warming are probably not possible, so we should focus on adapting to it instead. The problem is, at the rate global temperatures are rising, neither Brits nor the billions of people who live in more vulnerable countries can adapt to the disruption that will take place if we do not also rapidly cut greenhouse gas emissions. The UK's neighbors in Western Europe, one of the richest parts of the world, are already struggling to cope with even today's climate change impacts. Extremely high temperatures killed some 2,000 people in Portugal and Spain over 1 week in mid-July. In France, more than 75 square miles of forests have been destroyed in wildfires. Italy's longest river, the Po, has run dry, endangering this year's harvest at thousands of nearby farms. This is just the beginning. The authors of the UK's heat-minimizing editorials are a minority, but they hold great sway over the future of the government. Following the resignation of Prime Minister Boris Johnson July 7, the Conservative Party's in the middle of a leadership contest. The winner will be the next Prime Minister. The two contenders left in the race have largely voted against measures to respond to climate change. They will now seek endorsements from right-wing media outlets that are skeptical of the UK's 2050 net zero target and frame fossil fuel investment as the answer to the current crisis in energy prices. The back and forth of right-wing commentators and politicians functions as a closed loop that leaves out the vast majority of people who live in the UK. Those twisting climate impacts into a culture war claim they are fighting against progressive dogma and for greater flexibility in how we address our environmental challenges. But that definition of freedom amounts to a distraction, argues Tom Burke, a veteran UK government advisor and co-founder of climate think tank E3G. There is a whole group of the public who are really interested in freedom from all the things that will disrupt our lives if we do not deal with climate change. They are in battle with a smaller group of people who want the freedom to burn all the fossil fuels they want. The U.S. offers a warning for all countries that allow their national climate policy debate to become divorced from how the public actually experiences its impacts. As weather has become more extreme, support for policy action has increased. According to research published in April by Yale University, 87% of registered voters support tax incentives to make buildings more energy efficient. 77% back tax rebates for energy efficient vehicles or solar panels. 74% want carbon dioxide regulated as a pollutant. Yet Congress has failed to pass meaningful climate legislation, the effort repeatedly blocked in the Senate by a West Virginia Democrat who made a fortune selling coal. Meanwhile, in June, a bold new conservative majority on the Supreme Court sharply limited the EPA's ability to curb greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. As this historic summer continues on both sides of the Atlantic, people will keep feeling the heat. The climate movement needs to work a lot harder to make sure those in power feel it too. Papal apology. This is actually a very small article, more like a large caption of a colored photograph. It's framed by blue skies with greenery in the background, a green grassy lawn, and just a bit of a trail that looks like dark brown earth, upon which is parked Pope Francis in his white vestments and seated in a wheelchair. A person in a dark suit, white shirt and blue tie, gray hair, the Pope's is white, is pushing the wheelchair. In the background, a few more dark-clad men. On the ground, kneeling, is a dark-clad man in Bermuda shorts with a long-sleeved sweatshirt, a baseball cap, dark facial hair, headphones, and a video camera, professional looking, photographing the moment. Next to him, directly in front of the large green tree, are four probably tribal elders. They're dressed in buckskin or colorful clothing, shirts, with large eagle feather headdresses. And they are facing the side of the Pope, who looks pensive. His face is being held by his right hand. His eyes seem to be downcast or closed. And his cap, his little skull cap, is being held by his left hand. It's a papal apology. Pope Francis pauses in front of the site of the former Ermineskin Residential School in Mosquassis, Alberta, July 25, as part of a pilgrimage of penance. The Pope's meeting with Indigenous communities during his tour of Canada to apologize for the Church's harmful legacy. He has condemned in particular the system of largely Catholic-run residential schools that aimed to eliminate Indigenous culture and were rife with abuse. The bulletin, China's Mortgage Boycotts Spell Trouble, by Amy Gunia. Chinese authorities are working to quell a mortgage boycott before it sends shockwaves across the entire economy. The protest was started by home buyers dismayed by a slump in property prices and worried that indebted developers might not be able to finish their homes. Boycotts have now spread to hundreds of developments across the country. Plummeting prices may trigger social instability, warns Tianlei Huang of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Developers were already suffering from a slump, with construction stalled on millions of apartments over the past year. In China, it is common for buyers of new properties to begin paying mortgages before construction is finished. And some of these buyers have stopped paying. The boycotts now threaten to leave struggling property firms even more strapped for cash. Property behemoth China Evergrande Group defaulted on its debt in 2021, and at least a dozen other developers have defaulted on offshore bonds. A property sector bust could have major implications for China's wider financial system, which is heavily exposed to real estate. Everything's at stake for jittery, middle-class Chinese buyers who've piled their savings into property. Regulators are urging banks to extend loans to property developers. Censors have also been working overtime to scrub mentions of the strikes. Experts are hoping that tough down payment requirements, 30% is normal for first-timers, will mean that most home buyers won't walk away. The crisis strikes at the heart of China's development model, which has used construction and property sales to drive economic growth. Any attempt to reduce such investment would cause growth to slow sharply, says Michael Pettis, a professor at Peking University. In that case, it is hard not to get caught up in a vicious circle in which less investment means growth and less growth means less investment can be justified. From the news ticker, three short items. Russia to quit International Space Station. Russia said July 26 it would quit the International Space Station, ISS, which it jointly manages with NASA, after 2024. Russia said it would focus on building its own space station amid plans by NASA to transition to commercial stations after deorbiting the ISS in 2030. $52 billion chip bill clears Senate hurdle. The Senate, July 26, passed a bill that would give U.S. manufacturers $52 billion to produce semiconductor chips and invest in tech innovation. The legislation would reduce dependence on overseas manufacturers. It is expected to pass the House. Russia and Ukraine agree on grain. Russia and Ukraine agreed to a deal July 23 that would allow grain to be shipped out of the blocked Ukrainian port of Odessa in a breakthrough that could avert a hunger crisis in developing countries. Less than 24 hours later, two Russian missiles struck Odessa, throwing the resumption of exports into doubt. Good question. This is in the brief news. Why is it so hard to get tested for monkeypox? By Jeffrey Kluger. July 23, the World Health Organization declared monkeypox a global health emergency, with more than 16,000 cases in 75 countries. In the U.S., as of July 26, more than 3,500 cases have been reported in 46 states, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. Yet more than 2 months into the outbreak, Americans are still finding it too difficult to get tested for the disease. Part of the reason is there just are not enough tests. 67 federal labs and 5 private ones are authorized to perform monkeypox testing, giving the U.S. the capacity to process about 70,000 per week. But that is not enough to meet demand in hot spots. The New York City lab does under 20 tests a day, and they are at or near that capacity, says Joseph Osmundson, molecular biologist at New York University. Only people with lesions can get tested, even though other monkeypox symptoms like fever and headache often develop first. Test results can take days to return, delaying a patient's treatment and increasing the odds of passing on the virus. In any infectious disease outbreak, time is spread, says James Krellenstein, an AIDS activist and co-founder of the LGBTQ advocacy group PrEP for All. The vast majority of monkeypox cases so far have occurred in men who have sex with men. When we allow ourselves to be blinded to the extent of the outbreak, we allow this virus to spread, and we allow our communities to get harmed. The location of the lesions matters as well. Earlier in the outbreak, the CDC indicated only external lesions could be swabbed to be tested, Osmundson says, yet this is out of step with reality, given that internal lesions, particularly in the anus or rectum, can also occur as a result of sexual transmission. Confusion persists, even among healthcare providers, Osmundson says, because test kit directions say to only swab for external lesions. Roadblocks like these create exactly the kind of environment in which viruses thrive and spread, as we have seen all too recently with COVID-19. The vast majority of my epidemiologist friends believe this virus is not going away, says Osmundson. We need to go pedal to the metal with all possible interventions now. Here's a short article. Well, it's half a page below the monkeypox article, but it involves only 6-7 paragraphs, and they're short. Business Reversals of Fortune. This is by Nick Popley. It's been a difficult summer for Elon Musk, facing lawsuits and factory shutdowns. The world's richest person has his hands full, and more could be coming. Twitter lawsuit. Musk is preparing for an October trial, Twitter having sued him for backing out of a $44 billion acquisition agreement. Cheating claims. An alleged affair between Musk and the wife of Google co-founder Sergey Brin ruptured the billionaire's friendship, per the Wall Street Journal. Musk denied the story and the affair. Racial discrimination lawsuit. 15 black employees at Tesla filed a lawsuit against the electric car maker, alleging they were subjected to racial abuse and harassment at its factories. Baby drama. Documents show Musk recently fathered twins with Siobhan Zillis, a director at one of his companies, just weeks before he welcomed a child, his 10th, with musician Grimes. Factory shutdown. The electric vehicle maker reported its first sequential quarterly profit decline in more than a year, in part as a result of an extended shutdown at its Shanghai assembly plant. One wonders which factory it is, but in tiny, tiny print I see Tesla. SpaceX employee backlash. At Musk's private rocket company, some employees circulated an open letter calling his tweets a frequent source of distraction and embarrassment. The brief milestones, one page here with three articles, died, and they're all died today. Shanka Dukura by Boz Luhrmann. Shanka Dukura was authentically spiritual. Her inner life was large. You could see it through her actions and hear it in her voice. She played the singer Big Mama Thornton in my recent film Elvis, and she was a beloved gospel singer and teacher in Nashville. When we first encountered Shanka, she was singing, and you could hear how her voice lifted people up. That was really important to the film because Elvis was an intensely spiritual person himself, and I knew I would need great performers to shine a light on the seminal black artists who influenced him. Shanka really brought Big Mama Thornton to life with tremendous passion and confidence. And I'm grateful she was able to share her gift with a wider audience. Shanka was tragically found dead at age 44, July 21. She was just an extraordinary human being. And the writer of that article is a writer, director, and producer. Also died Ivana Trump, that's I-V-A-N-A. Straight-talking style icon by Dennis Basso, who was a designer. Ivana Trump had a very definitive style. She was really a product of the 80s and early 90s. She was tall. She was gorgeous. During that period, every major designer was clamoring to dress her. She loved life. She loved beautiful jewels, clothes, and furs. She left us too early, age 73, July 14. We first met when a mutual friend invited her to one of my fashion shows. I was in disbelief. She'd been at the front row of every major fashion show in Paris and Milan. Her husband, Donald, had just built Trump Tower. That evening, she showed up and took her front row seat in a beautiful gray cashmere outfit dressed to the nines. The show finished, and she came up to me and said, "I don't know you. I want to know you. I like your collection. Well done." She arrived unannounced at my office the next morning and told me she liked that I was working at 9:30 a.m. She said, "You know, you're cute. You're not cute, actually. You're rather handsome. A little chubby, but we could fix that." She bought 7 coats. On the way out, she said, "We will be friends. Send the bill to Trump Tower and write, 'Attention to the Donald.'" Soon, I was escorting her to the Met Gala and fancy dinners. It was just unbelievable. We became real friends. We weren't just chit-chit, kiss-kiss at a party friends. She was clearly not going to tell you what you wanted to hear. She was going to tell you what she thought. Divorce is always a difficult thing, but as time progressed, she and Donald were able to maintain a solid relationship. That's because they chose to rise above their differences and do it for their children and grandchildren. Ivana was a career woman, but she was also dressed 24/7. I imagine her philosophy as being, if you can't do it in 5-inch heels, then don't bother doing it. And finally, on the died page, Paul Sorvino by Andrew R. Chow. The two most iconic images of the actor Paul Sorvino could hardly be more different. In the first, he is slicing garlic with a razor blade as the ruthless Paulie Cicero in Goodfellas. In the second, he is weeping inconsolably at the 1996 Academy Awards while his daughter Mira dedicates her newly won Oscar to him. Sorvino, who died July 25 at 83, excelled at playing both the mobster and the softy, as well as everything in between. The son of an Italian immigrant, he carved out a 5-decade acting career, appearing in more than 100 films, television series, and plays. He received a Tony Award nomination for That Champion Season in 1973, played Henry Kissinger in Oliver Stone's Nixon, and Lord Capulet in Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, and starred for a season on Law and Order. Mira Sorvino said at the 1996 Oscars that her father taught me everything I know about acting. while perhaps best known for his hard, bitten roles, Sorvino admitted he really preferred to show off his gentler side. "I am a poet," he said in 2015. "I am an opera singer. I am an author. None of it is gangster." The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. The dark joke bounced around the Capitol when Senator Joe Manchin announced July 25 he had tested positive for COVID-19 and was isolating. It was an excuse for the West Virginia Democrat to skip a second consecutive lunch with colleagues openly critical of his unreliability. Joe Manchin's last name is spelled M-A-N-C-H-I-N. There is one problem with Democrats' rage. Manchin has always been a proud fly in the legislative ointment, an unrepentant naysayer to party orthodoxy who does not much care about his relationships in the Capitol. And that is why he will probably be the last statewide elected Democrat to represent West Virginia for a long time. He values his constituents' contempt of Washington far more than he fears his colleagues' contempt. And when it comes to President Joe Biden's frustrations with Manchin's singular and capricious veto-proof whimsy, Manchin truly cannot be bothered. Manchin had committed in private last year to supporting the parts of the second iteration of Biden's Build Back Better plan with plenty of strings attached. Manchin did not like parts of the first one, but promised to like the second one, that is, until the sequel also ran afoul of his need to scuttle huge swaths of Democrats' agenda, such as a tax hike on the wealthy. So Manchin pivoted and tried a third time to outline what he could accept, and Democrats acquiesced. And then again the proposal ran aground, because in Manchin's mind, more government spending would only hasten inflation. Welcome to governing in 2022, with Prime Minister Manchin running the show. The entire country's agenda is set by the one senator who stands in the breach. The Senate is split 50-50, and on matters extraneous to the budget, a 60-vote threshold is needed. However, if the Senate rulemaker gives the lawmakers a pass, Democrats can play with a 51-vote majority on anything deemed budget-adjacent, thanks to Vice President Kamala Harris's tie-breaking vote. If every member of the Senate's Democratic caucus sticks together to tuck novel ideas into the budget, they can actually get stuff like fighting climate change done. Manchin has long insisted he cannot hurt his constituents. That means catering to his state's vaunted but vanishing coal industry. Anything broaching green jobs is toxic for his coal country neighbors. Voters in West Virginia prize Manchin's perceived indifference to party politics, and Manchin likes to serve them a skillet of stick it to the man every chance he gets. It's a branding exercise that may perhaps keep him holding on through the next election cycle. President Donald Trump won West Virginia by 39 points in 2020. Manchin won re-election 2 years earlier by 3 points. Manchin knows his value to his party, and Democratic leaders are careful to give him sufficient space, but with limits. Manchin now says he may support a 2-year provision to cap prescription drug prices, but wants to wait till the fall for the big ticket items left in the queue, meaning they will slip past Election Day and likely into a lame duck Congress, when it will be too late for these measures to energize voters in tight races around the country. It becomes clear why so many of Manchin's colleagues in tough re-election fights hold him in such low esteem. The Coronavirus Brief by Kyla Mandel, senior editor. When clinical trials began testing COVID-19 vaccines, participants were not asked whether their menstrual cycle changed after the shots. But after the vaccine rollout, many people noticed their periods were heavier than normal after the jab. Initially, some clinicians were dismissive and chalked up the changes to stress. A survey of 39,000 respondents published in July in the journal Science Advances, however, found 41% of people with regular periods reported heavier bleeding after vaccination, while 44% said they did not notice any change. Older adults, people with reproductive conditions, those using hormonal contraceptives, and non-white or Hispanic Latinx people were especially likely to report this side effect. While changes to periods following a vaccine are not unheard of, the study notes, attention to these experiences is necessary to build trust in medicine. Experts cannot say yet how or even if the vaccine caused these changes. One hypothesis is it has to do with how the immune system responds to the vaccine. We suspect that for most people, the changes associated with COVID-19 vaccination are short-term, and we encourage anyone who's worried to contact their doctor, said co-author Catherine Lee, an anthropology professor at Tulane University, in a statement. We want to reiterate that getting the vaccine is one of the best ways to prevent getting very sick with COVID, and we know that having COVID itself can lead not only to changes in periods, but also hospitalization, long COVID, and death. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, Italy's Descent into Political Turmoil and Chaos. Italy's barreling toward an uncertain political future. Prime Minister Mario Draghi, the former European Central Bank president, who saved the Eurozone almost exactly a decade ago by pledging publicly to do whatever it takes to steer Europe through its sovereign debt crisis, has abandoned hopes of seeing Italy through its current time of troubles. Italy must now weather the storms created by the human and economic losses from the pandemic and the energy and security crises created by Russia's invasion of Ukraine with someone else in charge. Draghi will remain in his post until Italy holds a national election at the end of September, but his work as a leader of a rare unity government in Italy will remain unfinished. This last name is spelled D-R-A-G-H-I. I hope I'm pronouncing it somewhat correctly, and I apologize if I am not. Returning to the text, in the words of Ernest Hemingway, the downfall of Draghi's coalition came gradually, then suddenly. He agreed to form a government in February 2021, Italy's 19th in 33 years, only with support from both the left and the right. Given the crisis created by COVID-19 and the urgent need for help from the EU, most other major parties agreed. The center-left Democratic Party, the anti-establishment populist Five Star Movement, populist firebrand Matteo Salvini's hardcore nationalist Lega, and former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia all signed on. Over the past 17 months, sniping within the coalition has made Draghi's life difficult. But the need to secure relief funds from Brussels and the fear that new elections would unleash chaos held things together. But in June, the coalition began to fall apart. An increasingly hostile rift within the Five Star Movement, then between Five Star and Lega, provoked ultimatums. When Five Star threatened to leave the government, there was hope Draghi would continue as prime minister. But when Lega and Forza Italia insisted the price of their continued support would be a right-wing government in place of a unity coalition, Draghi resigned. This upheaval comes at a terrible time for Italy. This next election will mark the first time in decades that a national vote has taken place in autumn, a period usually reserved for passing a budget. and Italy needs to pass a budget to implement the reforms the European Commission demands in exchange for a promised 200 billion euro in grants and loans from the EU's Pandemic Relief Fund. That process will now be delayed because Italy's president dissolved parliament. Instead of fighting inflation, scrambling for ways to get through a difficult winter without Russian energy supplies, and helping consumers, Italy's leaders will be politicking, trading insults, and issuing political threats. Who will be the greatest beneficiary of this chaos? For now, the polls suggest an alliance of Italy's right-wing parties will form the next government. Salvini's Lega and Berlusconi's Forza Italia will have seats at the table, but the big winner will likely be the one major party that refused from the beginning to support Draghi's government, the nativist Brothers of Italy. And that means Italians may be on the verge of electing Giorgia Meloni as their first female prime minister. Meloni, at 45, has limited experience in government compared with some of her political opponents, but her right-wing ideas are deeply rooted. As a teenager, she joined the Italian Social Movement, a party inspired by fascist leader Benito Mussolini. In 2012, she became a founding member of the intensely anti-immigrant Brothers of Italy, Defense of God, Fatherland, and Family, and pledges to keep migrants out will likely feature in her campaign speeches. Her position on Europe will be much more nuanced. In the past, she's insisted EU treaties should be amended and Italian law should supersede EU rules. But she's never favored an Italian exit from the EU. And at a time when European money is crucial for Italian recovery, she is likely to downplay her party's Euroscepticism. Meloni is also unlikely to upset the EU consensus in support of Ukraine, and she has condemned Russia's invasion. Meloni's bid to become prime minister is no sure thing. Infighting among right-wing parties and sharp election season swings in public opinion could still shake things up. But Italy's next prime minister will not have Mario Draghi's crisis management experience or his inclination that problem-solving should transcend party politics. That is bad news for Italy. Under the brief health, there is a new number to call for mental health crises, 988. If you or someone you know may be experiencing a mental health crisis or contemplating suicide, call or text 988. For as long as she could remember, Tanya Miles had thoughts of suicide. After a childhood of sexual abuse, Miles turned to drugs and prostitution to mask the pain, she says, and twice she overdosed on prescription pills. After recovery, she worked as an advocate for improving mental health care in her home city of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, by sharing her story and working with others who had suffered trauma and struggled with mental illness. Still, in 2016, she had her own mental health crisis. She wrote a note to her family, collected some pills, drove to a secluded place where she planned to end her life. After her family discovered her note, persuaded her to come home, called 911, one of the officers who showed up recognized Miles from her presentations to law enforcement on crisis intervention and began speaking to her as someone experiencing an emotional crisis, not the way most law enforcement officers react to mental health calls, in which they manage every case as a threat to public safety. Miles avoided a trip to jail that day because of the responding officer's training. But even 6 years later, such a positive outcome from an emergency call involving mental health is the exception rather than the norm in the U.S. Even though emergency response systems for medical, Public safety and fire crises are well coordinated and integrated in nearly every community through 911. The same is not true for behavioral health or mental health crises. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is the closest thing the U.S. has to a mental health hotline. Yet it operates only about 200 unevenly distributed, underfunded call centers. Till now, July 16, the federal government phased out the Lifeline's clunky number, 800-273-8255, and launched a new three-digit number, 988, for anyone in a mental health crisis. The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline dramatically expands the capacity of existing call centers with the goal of instantaneously connecting people in crisis to mental health professionals. When a person calls 988, a certified counselor at a call center, ideally located near that person, will attempt to guide them through the crisis. This will be enough to mitigate most situations, but when more help's needed, dispatchers will send a mobile crisis team made up of mental health experts and peer support counselors. People who've recovered from their own mental health crises and help others in similar situations. If those interventions are not sufficient, 988 will also direct people to stabilization facilities, mental health centers where trained staff can observe and provide additional counseling and support, or residential facilities for longer-term care. Those settings are more appropriate for people with mental health crises than where they currently end up, the emergency room, jail, or in the worst cases, the morgue, if the incident escalates violently. Most of the country still relies on 911 to manage mental health crises, says Dr. Ashwin Vasan, New York City Health Commissioner. 988 represents probably the most potentially transformative federal legislation in mental health that we have seen in decades. But there are massive hurdles to turning that vision into reality. 988 will require building a compassionate crisis response system in a country that's historically underfunded and dismissed mental health services. Funding, staffing, and insurance reimbursements will all be a struggle. We're sitting in the context of a system that's fragmented and frankly has a lot of gaps in terms of providing services for individuals, says John Palmieri, director of 988 and Behavioral Health Crisis at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which funds the Lifeline and is helping states implement 988. The new crisis line represents the first major investment, $432 million from the federal government, in mental health services in the country in decades, and it could not come at a more crucial time. Mental health struggles among Americans have reached unprecedented levels because of the pandemic and the widespread anxiety, depression, and emotional stressors that have resulted from lockdowns, disease, and job losses. Rates of depression and anxiety among adults in the U.S. were four times as high from April 2020 to August 2021. As they were in 2019, according to federal data. Every 11 minutes, an American died by suicide in 2020. Rates of depression and anxiety are rising especially quickly among teens. Mental health professionals are struggling to keep up with the demand. 988 could help shoulder some of it. There may be a wait list for counseling, but if you're in a crisis, you can reach out and talk to someone right now, says Shelby Zurich Beasley, Associate Director of Crisis Services at Provident Behavioral Health, a nonprofit community mental health center in St. Louis. The transformative potential of 988 is huge, says Dr. Margie Balfour, Chief Clinical Quality Officer at Connections Health Solutions, a nonprofit provider of behavioral health services in Tucson, Arizona. This is Mental Health Crisis Cares Carpe Diem Moment. Since it launched in 2005, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline Network has provided critical support in de-escalating urgent mental and behavioral health incidents. A 2018 study of Lifeline callers who were interviewed anonymously found that 80% said follow-up calls from counselors made them feel supported and diverted them from carrying out suicide plans. But even as the demand grew, a lack of funding prevented it from expanding. In 2018, Congress passed the National Suicide Hotline Improvement Act to explore a three-digit, easy-to-remember hotline number so more people could access help. In 2020, 988 was designated as the new digits to dial. Along with the number, the federal government is providing significant grants to states to increase their crisis call center capacity. The American Rescue Plan of 2021, which was passed to offer emergency funding to address the pandemic, included $105 million in additional funding for mental health resources to enable the transition to 988. But such funds are finite, and it is now up to states to find additional money to continue supporting the centers after the grants run out. While states reported in spring 2021 their collective pot for supporting call centers was around $30 million, in the past year, legislatures have committed additional funds and have now allocated $200 million for implementing 988. The vision for 988 requires a total reimagining of crisis support and, by extension, of public safety. Across the country, armed law enforcement officers are currently the default responders to almost every situation. A 2015 study found the mentally ill were shot by police at a rate of 16 times that of other civilians. SAMHSA is urging states to train 911 dispatchers to recognize and route mental health emergencies to 988, where trained professionals can take over. Another priority is adding mobile crisis teams, which 988 responders can deploy instead of law enforcement or emergency medical personnel, as well as a network of stabilization facilities. There's a graphic here in the middle of this page. The source is the National Academy for State Health Policy. It's a map of the United States. Most of it's in white with several blobs in bright red. Backing the lifeline, 21 states as of June 29 have enacted legislation to support rollout of the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. I'll read through them very quickly. Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Nevada, starting from the west or the left and reading across. Utah, Colorado, Nebraska, Kansas, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Minnesota, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, West Virginia, Virginia, Maryland, New York, Connecticut. North Carolina is not one of them. To illustrate 988's potential to transform care, advocates point to Arizona, whose legislature has budgeted for mental health crisis care since 2009. The funds support mobile crisis teams and reimbursement for care provided by a network of facilities. For example, the Phoenix metropolitan area, which includes a population of nearly 5 million, operates 30 mobile teams run by a variety of providers and mental health facilities. Medicaid covers these services for beneficiaries, and the state subsidizes the costs for people who are uninsured or privately insured. The state's fund also pays for care facilities that accept people for longer-term care, regardless of their insurance status, which eases the responsibility for officers to serve as street-corner psychiatrists, says Kevin Hall, assistant chief of the Tucson Police Department. Tucson has started embedding behavioral health clinicians in 911 call centers to help dispatchers determine if a caller needs to be connected to 988 rather than law enforcement or emergency medical support. Replicating such investment will not be possible in every state, but officials from other states have consulted with Arizona's administrators. Ultimately, the best way to persuade insurers to cover crisis care and states to budget additional resources is proving doing so saves money in the long run. Already, some pilot studies show this investment is more cost-effective than having people cycle repeatedly through the criminal justice system or hospital emergency departments. 988 now provides a unique opportunity to collect data on a large scale. Tanya Miles knows how life-changing better crisis care can be, being treated compassionately by a trained professional during her own emergency saved her life. She now works as a pastor and peer support specialist helping others in crisis. I never thought I would see anything like 988 happen in my lifetime, she says. While it is a call for help, it also has to be a connection to hope. This article was abbreviated, and again, if you or someone you know may be experiencing a mental health crisis or contemplating suicide, call or text 988. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.